Hi, this is Tony Robbins. Welcome to another edition of Power Talk. You know, normally I start out these Power Talks talking about how excited I am, but quite honestly, I'm not excited. I'm exhausted. I'm just thrilled to be home and have this chance to visit with you. You see, I just gotten back from a 90-day tour where I went to 6 countries and 34 cities, and where I conducted virtually every type of seminar I've ever thought of or created, and where I did a mass amount of media exposures and interviews, and where I interviewed people within those cultures who have helped to shape those countries so that I could understand the process of change and improvement and expanding the quality of life from multiple perspectives. And if there is something I'm excited about, quite honestly, it's that having gone to each of these cultures has really caused me to take another look at the change process. Not just how to change ourselves individually or in a small community, a family or a small company, but how do we change entire communities? How do we change entire nations? Because right now there's a pattern of change that's occurring throughout the industrialized world that's going to affect every aspect of your personal and professional life. And if we fail to anticipate this change, we're going to experience pain. And if we do anticipate it, we can take advantage. We can have an edge. We can create a greater quality of life than we ever have before. This pattern of change, you wonder what it is. Well, I'm not going to tell you just yet. You got to think as usual and stay with me a little bit here. I will tell you this, though. This simple pattern of change that's happening throughout the industrialized world that I want to talk with you about, there is a danger that when I talk with you about it, that you'll see it as something that's happening to someone else, that you'll see it as being something that has nothing to do with your personal life because, you know, after all, nothing like this has ever happened to you in the past. The process of change, as we know it, has changed radically. We've always had change. But what we're well aware of now, and it's almost a cliche to even say it, is that what's different about change today is it's happening more rapidly than ever before, but also changes are happening in a discontinuous fashion. Meaning, we used to have continuous change. You could say, well, things are going to get better. You know, we know what change is going to be. We may not know the details, but we know that the next generation is going to be better off than this generation. We know that whatever we're doing here in our business, we're just going to do it better next year. Well, that's not necessarily true anymore. Change today can happen instantaneously in a way that we cannot anticipate, or at least have not anticipated before, where suddenly we're not doing it better, we're doing something completely different at this company. So what I'm trying to say to you is, before I talk to you about this simple pattern, this affects you personally. This is going to affect you. If it isn't doing affecting you now, it's going to affect you in the near future. It'll affect you whether you own your own company, whether you're an executive for a corporation, whether you're just entering the workforce, or if you're never even planning on working and you're a homemaker, because it's going to affect the structure of how your family even functions. So what the heck am I talking about here? What I'm speaking to you about is the radical changes that we're seeing in the structure of work in industrialized societies. What the heck does that mean? Well, you and I have lived with a certain set of assumptions, at least most of us in industrialized countries have up until now. And that was that, hey, half of your life, basically, your adult life, you were going to drive someplace, you were going to go to work at that location. If you really did work hard and you really added value, you would continue to work for that company unless you chose to leave. And if the company got into trouble, at the very worst, you would have experience at this corporation that would be marketable to go to work for somebody else. And sure enough, you planned your life based around that, because the structure of how we work determines dinner times, determines when you're going to see your children. It determines to a great extent how you think about your future, what you think is possible, what you think is impossible. So what's changed? You say, I'm still going to the same job. I'm still doing the same thing. Well, one thing that's changed is the future. What's happening is these companies, in an effort to try and compete, are changing the structure of corporations and therefore the number of jobs and the types of jobs that are available. This has changed the way people think about their future. It even changes the way some people look at their present. Some people say, well, when is it going to return to normal? No. This is normal. This is the new status quo, continuous change with corporations and organizations trying to reorganize so they can compete more intensely in a world market. And the impact of their decision-making is changing the structure of work. You say, what do you mean about the structure of work? So far, you just talked about unemployment. Well, here's what's really changing. Companies are beginning to realize that the structure of a company, and if you're an executive, you certainly know this and are probably already addressing it, that you want to have a company that is flexible, that can change quickly and radically to meet the changing desires, modes, and needs of today's consumer, and a company that's competing on a world scale. In order to do that, they're trying to make sure they have the smallest amount of cost, and they started something called outsourcing. What's outsourcing? They're saying, why should we do our own accounting? Let's have an outside firm do that. Why should we employ somebody to stock all of our materials? Let's have the company that's selling us this stuff keep things in stock and manage it. And as a result, you're seeing these big corporations shrinking, and lots of small businesses are starting up. Now, what does that mean? And what is the impact upon your life? Well, the first thing it does, it destabilizes the one area of your life most people take for granted. We have all these assumptions. Well, I know what work is, and I know how I'm going to work, and I know how it's going to happen, and I'm going to have this one employer. No, you're going to have multiple employers, most people. In fact, for most countries, it now appears if the momentum continues in the direction it's going, and there's no reason for it not to, as you'll see in a moment as I explain to you what the force is that's causing this change. But if it continues to move in this direction, approximately half of our population will be living outside what we currently call the norm of employment, called full-time employment. Half the people will be part of outsourcing. Half the people have part-time employment or multiple employers. That's an amazing change. Think about what that will do to your family life. Think about what that does to your time. Think about what that does to your sense of certainty about the future. Think about what that demands from you in terms of your ability to create quality so you can continue to have the same customer as an employer. Pretty soon your employer becomes your customer if you work for someone else in any way, shape, or form. And if you have your own business, it means you're looking at running your business differently. Well, you're more flexible. Well, you can hire somebody for the short term and then let them go as you make a change in the way you run your business without upsetting anyone, without creating a bunch of economic challenges, giving you the flexibility and power to meet the marketplace. Now, what is causing this change? Why are so many people now part-time employed? Is it because there just aren't the jobs? No, that's not the reason. The reason is we're running into three or four new factors that are part of our world society that are causing businesses to make changes. The first one is technology. Recall we already said that change has always occurred, but it's happening more rapidly now than ever before. And a major source of the speed of change is technology. Because number one, it's changing the way companies operate because corporations are finding that through new machines, new technology, new innovations, they can now get the same job done or a better job done with no human beings. They can eliminate dozens or sometimes hundreds of jobs. This has happened for major corporations in their accounting departments. Just imagine a bank that had multiple outlets and the hundreds of accountants they used to have versus the dozens that they now have to get the same job done, where any executive can get the information they need at their fingertips at almost the speed of light. This has also happened in industries as simple as farming. We used to have 30 million farmers in this country who helped us to feed 100 million people. That was at the turn of the century. Today, we have 1% of those farmers. We have 300,000 farmers in the entire nation, and they feed 300 million people because of technology. Not only everybody in this nation, but we feed people overseas as well. So technology is changing the pace of change, and it's making businesses have to change more rapidly. Because if your competition begins to get this kind of technology, he or she can leave you in the dust. So all of a sudden, you can't be like Henry Ford, where he made one product and the life cycle of that product was a generation. The Model T was sold to a generation. Today, the product life cycle of any product has shrunk down to as little as 6 months to a year and a half. Many companies create products now knowing that it's only going to last in the marketplace for as little as 6 to 9 months. Can you imagine? Now, if that's true of a product, you can imagine what that means to jobs. If we're only going to make that product for that period of time, unless the person in the job has multiple skills, we're going to have to find somebody else to do what we're going to make now, or what we're going to sell now, or what we're going to market now. This technology is changing the way businesses operate. And the other factor is technology is changing the way we work because we no longer have to go to one central place to work. Technology now allows people to live virtually wherever they want and do much of their business. Because much of the business of the information society is manipulating ideas or words or sounds or images on computers or other forms of systems, or it's negotiations, it's communication through telephones. We're in a situation today between computers and faxes and modems. We're in a position where many people can choose to live virtually anywhere, and it totally changes their idea of the workplace, the work environment, where they can do business, how many countries they can do business in, which brings up the next major factor that's affecting the pace of change and therefore your work life, and that is competition. Because of technology, we truly have a competitive world. because people now from virtually anywhere in the world can interact. They can do business. They can make offers. They can come up with concepts. They can synergize between one another. This is creating a world where there are so many people participating and producing products and services that there's been a huge change in the balance between supply and demand. I mean, think about it. This generation has learned a different lesson than previous generations about buying products and services, and they're affecting the workplace. This generation has learned that there is no scarcity of products, that there are lots of products out there, that if you want a fax machine, there are multiple numbers of fax machines out there, that you can kind of pick and choose what you want. There is so much competition out there that it's making every business have to work harder to be more profitable. They have to add more value for less money. And as a result, that's why many of them have turned to downsizing or resizing to try and figure out how to compete. But downsizing and resizing is not the answer, as we're going to find out here. The third factor that's going to shape the way businesses are conducted and therefore the structure of your future work is demographics and psychographics. What the heck does that mean? Well, if an economy is driven by consumers, and what consumers spend money on determines where businesses put their attention, who gets employed and who doesn't, then we have to look at who are the major consumers of our economy. In fact, who's the major person shaping our society? Well, there was a generation that has controlled and directed our society for years, and they were the major purchaser of products and services up until fairly recently. And that generation was the World War II generation. Now, if you look at this generation, they went through a depression where they felt like they had almost nothing, scarcity, and then they went through a war. And by the way, when somebody said, hey, we're going to go to war, they didn't say why. They reported immediately, Johnny come marching home type of an attitude, right, from a previous war, and they went right out immediately, and they knew the world was black and white. It was clear who was the good guy, who was the bad guy, and if you played by the rules and you respected authority and did the right thing, you'd come back a hero, and they did. And these people, when they came back and they finally wanted to have some pleasure, they wanted a better quality of life, some of the technology created options and new technology provided ways for them to have a better life with less pain. And they moved to things called suburbs and new development, and they wanted to purchase items, things like refrigerators. And in those days, getting a refrigerator was an exciting thing. Getting a television was an exciting thing. Think about that process. They wanted their kids to grow up and have all this great pleasure. And so they raised their children with a different set of values in some cases. In many cases, they taught their kid a different lesson. They taught their kid that you're special. You're unique. You know what? I want you to be happy. Your happiness is the most important thing. If they didn't say it verbally, they said it by their actions. If a young person from World War II generation broke the rules, they knew they were going to get pain for it. But if this baby boom generation, the generation that came out of this group, the generation that's now starting to be the largest consumer base in the history of Western civilization, this mass number of births that came from these people came back from World War II, they wanted pleasure, they had kids. These kids learned not to go out there and work 7 days a week and work really hard. They didn't learn to take care of everybody else first. What many of them learned was your happiness is the most important thing in life. I want you to be happy. I want you to have a better life than I have. You're going to be more intelligent. You're going to go to school. You're going to get an education. These people grew up with a different environment, and they learned that breaking the rules could be fun. Because after all, guys like Dr. Spock entered in and said, hey, if your kid breaks the rules, you got to let him kind of explore and discover himself. A little different society began to be shaped. And what happened is we developed a culture of people that learned to break the rules and learned it could actually be enjoyable to break the rules. You might create an identity by breaking the rules. These people, when drugs were available and they, of course, didn't know the consequences, of course they'd be willing to use a drug. Why wouldn't you? It's a way to be happy. One of the things they were programmed to do. If they did go to war, did they have a real clear idea of why they were there? Was there clear authority? Was it clear who the good guy was and who the bad guy was? The answer is no. These people went into an environment where they were not clear at all, where they might be sitting in a rice paddy next to a guy smoking a joint, where they weren't sure why they were even there. They had not been raised to have an ideology that was singular and focused. And sure enough, one day, let's say somebody's out there and he likes children, and he's there with his buddy doing a patrol, and he finds this little boy. He starts talking to him. Of course, he can't speak his language, but he thinks he's cute. And he turns around to walk away, and the little boy pulls out a machine gun and blows away his best friend. And in an effort to save his own life, he turns and pulls his machine gun and blows the young child away. What do you think that does to a generation? What did it do to you if you're part of that generation? And by the way, when these people finally did come home, did they win? Did they have parades celebrating? No, they were called baby killers. Many people spit on them. What do you think that did to them? While they're gone, their heroes were killed. A Kennedy, a King. The president of the United States said that he was leaving office, but he was not a crook. This was a bit confusing for a few people. What did this generation learn? What many people in this generation learned was loyalty to anything can get you killed for no good reason. In fact, some songs with similar verses actually became very popular. Think about it. How does this affect today's society? Well, the leading edge of this group of people we now call baby boomers have a bit of money to spend. They have capital and they're going to make a decision, but they don't make it the same way as past consumers. Number one, they know there's unlimited supply. They've learned that they can have whatever they want. And they don't just want a product. They want a product that meets their individual needs. They want a product with their name on it. World War II generation had three flavors of ice cream: strawberry, chocolate, and vanilla. How many are there now? God only knows, right? Ben and Jerry showed up. This generation wants ice cream with their signature on it, their own personal one, to meet their own personal needs. They want to buy from somebody who knows that they're special and unique. Anyone who shows them that they care about them at that level, who knows they're special and unique, just like mommy and daddy taught them, is going to get their attention. But also, you got to remember, this person is choosy and jaded. They don't have to have it. Anybody who wants a refrigerator now, anybody who wants a VCR within reason, has already got it. So now they don't have to buy. They're not driven by scarcity. They're very, very choosy. You got to give them everything. They've learned by Japanese competition that they can not only have, let's say, the best quality, but they can also have the best price in the same item and have selection and have service. That's now the norm. Now this group of people expect everything. And as a result, since you can't get them to buy unless you meet their needs, and their needs are so much higher, businesses cannot operate the same way they used to. So now they have to be so flexible, because these people's idea of what they want can change very quickly. And by the way, as a result of these demographic and psychographic changes, changes in psychology, changes in who's actually purchasing what, we're also finding companies like Sears are having difficulty. You know why? Because these people won't buy from Sears just because they always have. They're not loyal to a company. They're not loyal to a name. Many brand names are wondering, how are we going to compete? Why are we losing some consumers? It's because this new consumer, and by the way, this new consumer is starting to run these multinational companies. This new consumer is somebody whose needs are much different than anybody you've ever met before. In addition, our entire society is changing because this new consumer is also the person running the nation. The president of the United States now is a baby boomer, as is the vice president. Think about it. Heads of multinational corporations now are baby boomers. Who are baby boomers? They are rule breakers. They're not willing to do things just because it was always done that way. Oftentimes, they like change. They want change to happen. We promised full-time employment. That was then. This is now. Today, to compete, we got to change it all. They've changed the economy wherever they've gone. There's a good metaphor for them. It's like a giant pig going through a snake. You know, when baby boomers were all born, guess what happened? Diaper sales went crazy because of this huge number of people who needed diapers. When all of a sudden they went to school, we needed more schools. When all of a sudden they've grown up and went into business in the financial markets, there's a stimulation in that area. So what all this is causing to occur is we've got a situation now where we have a very choosy consumer who now requires a tremendous amount. They want every bit of value they've ever gotten and then some. They want things to always be better, and they want them to be cheaper, and they want service, and they want supply, and that's what they expect, or they're not going to buy. So gradually, there are a few companies that have figured out how to succeed, and they are the model by which other companies are now beginning to create change. Their model is not one of continuous improvement. Their model is, how do we make radical changes in the way in which we actually conduct our business so that we make dramatic improvements in what we can give the consumer and dramatic improvements in our profitability simultaneously? Companies that are leading the charge are some of the telephone companies like GTE, where they've figured some ways to have their costs and in many places double their profits. I mean, that's significant. Now, to do this, though, requires massive change in the structure of how they actually conduct their business and how work is actually occurring in these businesses. Now, a couple of business experts by the names of Michael Hammer and James Champy followed along some of these success stories, and they gave a term to what these companies were doing. It's called re-engineering. In its technical term, it's called business process re-engineering. Big term. You go, oh my gosh, I don't want to hear this. I don't need to re-engineer a business. I'm not even into engineering. Well, you might want to re-engineer your life when you understand what it really is. It's a way to dramatically improve the quality of your life by basically asking some new questions. All human progress is preceded by a new question. Remember, thinking is nothing but the process of asking and answering questions. But as we learn from people like Dr. Deepak Chopra, the average person has 66,000 thoughts in a day. The problem is that 95% of the thoughts you had today are the same ones you had yesterday. That creates a bit of a challenge if you want to create change. We tend as human beings to become habituated to a way of thinking, to a way of working, to a way of doing business. And that habituation, those habits, keep us from being able to grow, expand, and create a better quality of life. So let me tell you what's great. All these things I've told you about in terms of change may scare you. You say, oh my gosh, you know, the work is changing, the world's changing, things are not so stable, I can't count on things being the same way. You're absolutely right. All these things are going to happen, and what they're going to do is they're going to become sources of pain that will make our society change. But it's going to make our society a lot more exciting, because you're never going to be able to sit around and do the same thing over and over and over again and get bored again. You're going to have to be alive. You're going to have to think. You're going to have to create. 75% of all jobs are going to have a cerebral base, meaning they're going to require intelligence. You're going to have to think. You're going to have to be creative. You're going to have to approach your life differently. This whole process of re-engineering is how do we use human creativity to change the way a business functions so it adds more value and is more profitable too. I want to take this concept of re-engineering and show you how to use it for your life. How do you re-engineer your life? In fact, I've created a term a step beyond that that we're going to get to in a moment called regeneration. But as far as re-engineering is concerned, what these companies have done is make dramatic changes in the way in which they conduct their businesses. In fact, the literal definition of re-engineering, as Champion Hammer describe it, is it's the radical redesign of business processes. Business processes might be the way a business manufactures something. It might be the way it markets it. It might be the way it distributes it or delivers it. Any part of the business. A business is made up of nothing but a series of processes. So it's the radical redesign of business processes to achieve major gains in either cost, service, or time. What you basically do with reengineering is you take out a fresh piece of paper and you say, if we were going to start this business from scratch, or if we're going to start manufacturing this in a brand new way, if we were going to start marketing this from scratch, we never had any background at all, we threw away all of our assumptions, how would we do it? In other words, you ask questions like, what do we do as a company and why do we do it that way? And instead of justifying and saying, well, it's the best way, we always know it because it's always worked, just remember, you want to throw out all your past assumptions and start to question. And as we start to question why things are done a certain way, and we start to re-examine it and re-evaluate it, what businesses are finding is by getting people's creativity, people from all portions of the company, not just the top down, not just a bunch of executives, people that are involved in the process of conducting the business, that they're able to create huge changes in profitability and what they add in terms of value to the customer. GTE, for example, sat down and said, we want to make a radical change in our ability to meet our customers' desires and needs. So the first thing you got to do is find out, what do they really want? So they began to poll people and say, what do our customers really want? Their biggest complaint is they got to call 14 different numbers to get different services. What they love is one 1-800 number they could call, and when they call that number, they could either get call waiting, or they could find out about their bill, or they could find out what's wrong with their darn telephone from the same operator, and they have it available 24 hours a day instead of just during normal business hours. And so as a result, they said, well, what if we did that? They said, well, we can't do that because they have to call a different number for us to install a different service than to check what's wrong with their lines, because the equipment's in a different place. It requires different people who have different skills. The people at GTE said, throw out all your past beliefs, and instead, let's just take and pretend, what if we put all this machinery in one place? And what if our operators learned to run those same machines? So when somebody called up and said, what's wrong with my phone, instead of filling out a request form from the service department to find out what's wrong, they could test the equipment right there while the person was on the line and say, here's your problem and here's what we're doing about it. Well, long story short, everybody said it cost too much, it wouldn't be done. The reality is, what GTE is finding is that they're able now to have one number that people can call. They're able to get information resolved. Instead of saying, here's how fast we get to customers, which is what they used to measure, they now say, how often on the first call can we resolve all the customers' needs? And what they're finding is they have quadrupled the times in which they met all the customers' needs, which makes the customer thrilled, makes them want to do more business with you, and they've also cut their costs in half in many places. It's an amazing process of reengineering. Another good example of this is Hallmark Corporation. I happen to be working with them now, and they're re-engineering and communicating some of the changes to their entire organization. At Hallmark, they didn't wait till they had problems to begin to do re-engineering. They were one of the companies that had some real foresight. And what they began to do is they looked around at the marketplace and they saw what I'm telling you now, that the marketplace was becoming fragmented, that all of a sudden all these individual people wanted their individual needs met. They didn't want chocolate, strawberry, or vanilla. So they began to look at it and say, okay, how do we conduct our business and why do we conduct it that way? What do we need to do to really be successful in our business? And what they began to realize is the first thing is they had to be able to respond more quickly to their consumers. That right now, to create a new product took 2 to 3 years before they got it actually on the shelf, to create a greeting card, as you can imagine. Now, this is a company that has tremendous resources. The largest creative staff of any company in the world. They have, I think, 700 or 800 artists and writers to create these products every single day. They produce 22,000 different items a year. But this company was still taking 2 to 3 years to get it to the marketplace. Well, the marketplace is changing so rapidly, they weren't meeting the marketplace's needs. So here's what they did. They said, we have to get our team together and start to re-engineer this. We've got to get our creative people to see that time is money, that somehow we've got to be able to do in less than a year what usually takes us 2 or 3 years. That's a major dramatic change. Secondly, we got to know what our consumer wants. So they started creating barcoding, and they started taking some of the Hallmark stores that they owned and beginning to find out immediately through information technology which cards are the hottest selling cards, which ones aren't moving, so they could immediately change their print runs. And so they could teach all the other people that distribute Hallmark cards which products should be displayed and which ways to produce the greatest sales. To make a long story short, Hallmark's focus on re-engineering is allowing them to remain the leader in the field by giving them more flexibility to meet the marketplace. And this re-engineering is just now being implemented, and I have the privilege of being a part of communicating some of these changes to their retail distributors throughout the country. The president of Hallmark told me that all of this re-engineering has one primary focus: to give Hallmark the ability to respond to a world that is now based on continuous and unexpected change. To put Hallmark in the position where they know what the customer wants, they can meet their needs immediately with flexibility and the least amount of cost, so they can not only compete but remain the dominant leader in their industry. But I have to tell you, re-engineering is not like the newest fad. It is the future for virtually any organization that's going to thrive and prosper. What it's really about is, how do we redesign the system in which we create our products and take them to the customer and provide service for the customer? How do we redesign the system so it adds more value and costs less to do? That's the bottom line of re-engineering, to make it as simple as possible. And it's accomplished by taking out a fresh piece of paper, throwing out all the ideas you have, and putting all those people responsible together in a room and saying, how would we do this if we were starting from scratch? Now, the truth of the matter is, you could do this with your personal life, couldn't you? Aren't there areas of your personal life that could be re-engineered? Aren't there areas where you're doing things that really don't make total sense? Or maybe it makes total sense based on the past. But if you were to totally rethink things, isn't there a more efficient way of doing things, a more enjoyable way of doing things? We all have systems we're not even aware of, just out of habituation. Like, for example, the way you get up in the morning and how you get prepared and what you do. Maybe instead of going to the cleaners twice a week and traveling there and spending time in line and finding a parking place and coming out, you get a cleaner that picks up your clothes and delivers them back at home. You don't even have to think about the process. Again, that's awfully simplistic. But you know something? At Life Mastery, we interviewed a gentleman by the name of Rick Newland. Some of you are familiar with him. He's a young man who jumped into a wave one day as a surfer in Orange County, and he hit the wave wrong, and it snapped his spine. He became a quadriplegic instantaneously. And no one was sure he would live, but through a process of not just re-engineering, but what I would again call regeneration, he has reorganized the way he lives his life in a way that gives him immense pleasure and allows him to do most of the things he used to do, but in a brand new way, causing him to use different resources to get the job done. He's an amazing man. But the bottom line is, there was something he said when I was interviewing him in front of the group I thought was interesting. He said, you know, I think that most people know how to deal with the walls in life, smacking against the wall. He said it's the pebbles that really screw our life up, the things that kind of knock you out of state, that those little things that just drive you crazy, and then all of a sudden you snap at your spouse, or you give up, or you get burnt out and tired and don't give 1,000% of your effort. So those little things are what really screw us up. So part of re-engineering also in your personal life might be, how do I get rid of as many pebbles as possible? How do I re-engineer my home life, etc.? And the only thing I thought of after I started really studying re-engineering in more detail was, it became obvious from all the statistics that had been collected that between 50 and 70% of all the companies that begin a re-engineering process fail. That is, the re-engineering process does not succeed. Now, after all this buildup I've given up to re-engineering, you say, oh my gosh, what's the matter here? And that's according, by the way, to Michael Hammer and James Champy, the guys who came up with this whole term and have really studied the process in as probably as much detail as anyone. And as I looked at that, I said, okay, why is it failing? And I realized that reengineering is only part of the process of creating a dramatic and lasting change in an organization, in a business, or even a person's personal life. So I started thinking about all that I know about change and all that I was studying, and I began to create a different concept, and a concept I now call regeneration. Now, what the heck is regeneration? Well, by definition, regeneration for me is the process of using human ingenuity to transform dormant resources. Dormant meaning something you're just not currently using. I don't care if it's a skill or an understanding or an ability you have. If it's a corporation, it might be people you're not using. It might be resources, computers that are not being fully utilized. I don't care what it is, but it's a transforming dormant resources into significant assets that powerfully increase the quality of our lives. What regeneration really is how do you use the resources you already have to create something new, something greater, something better than ever existed before? It's like, how do we produce a rebirth in our lives, a rebirth in a company? That's what regeneration meant to me. So I looked at that and I said, okay, there are so many resources that are underutilized. That's one of my passions in life, is showing people how to use more of their resources. Most people are asleep. That's what awaken the giant within is all about, right? Wake up and use the resources that are there. Well, that has to happen within companies or they can't stay profitable. That has to happen within communities and countries or they can't compete. I mean, think about it. What are we capable of as human beings when we really tap into our creativity, into our ingenuity? Unbelievable things. See, what gives things value in the 21st century is human creativity. It's brain power. See, brain power gives you the ability to add the most value to any natural resource. Listen, we learned how to turn dirt into a $150 billion a year industry, right? Computers. We turn sand into silicon chips to store information, to transfer information that has changed the structure of work. That came out of human creativity, ingenuity, somebody who was willing to throw away all the old belief systems. Because to build these things, to build these computers, to build computer chips, they had to believe the opposite of what everybody believed before them. They had to re-engineer their thoughts. They had to regenerate. They had to say, you know what? Better is cheaper. That was never thought of before. They had to say, you know what? When things move faster, they're going to get cooler. These are core beliefs that were necessary to have these breakthroughs happen in the computer industry. This fries most people's brains. But see, this is how change happens. And you and I, every single person that you're going to meet, has this well of creativity inside of them, but it hasn't been tapped before because it hasn't had to be tapped. Because human beings only tap into their real ability when things are a must, not a should. And for most people, change has been a should. But I'm here to tell you, here is what's exciting. Here's the payoff of this tape. We are living in a society now where the demands are so much higher on business that we have to get more creative than ever before. And that is every person's niche who's willing to develop themselves, train themselves to use their mind and body in brand new ways to add more value. That's what everything I do is based upon. That's what Power Talk's based upon. That's what Master University is. How do we regenerate the quality of life by tapping into those unused resources and turning them into assets that improve the quality of not only our lives, but other people's as well? Let's come back to reengineering just for a second, though. You say, what's the difference between regeneration and reengineering? Well, reengineering is one of five steps that help you to regenerate, that is to create anew, to produce a lasting, massive, dramatic change in your life, in an organization, in a community, in a family, in a country. Now, why hasn't reengineering worked in some cases? Because people have gotten together and designed some new systems that need to be implemented, but they haven't followed through. They haven't taken action. They haven't retrained people. They haven't reassured people that, hey, this will work out. You know, trust me, go for it, follow through. So many times organizations have come up with a good reengineering plan, but they never implement it. Out of fear of the unknown, out of fear of loss. People in the organization maybe have secondary gain. They're afraid, well, if we re-engineer, what will that do to my job? What will that do to my sense of control? But we have to let go of that because otherwise these organizations won't be around to be able to provide those kinds of jobs for people. The truth of the matter is sometimes organizations have even implemented these changes, but they still aren't succeeding. Because I think the first step to regeneration, step number one, is you must reinvent yourself. Whether it be you that you're trying to regenerate, like let's say you want to regenerate your own body and look and feel better and have a new identity, or whether it be government wanting to reinvent itself, or whether it be a corporation. For example, a company like Xerox can produce a brand new set of products and services. They can re-engineer the company so it's no longer based on producing photocopy machines. But as long as people think of Xerox as the company that you go to make copies of pieces of paper on, then they're in trouble because we're living in a society where most of that's done on computer now. There's less and less actual paper transferring hands. They're in trouble. They have to reinvent their identity, which they're in the process of doing now. Of course, Xerox is now becoming the document company. And as a result, you start seeing fax machines, you start seeing modems, you start seeing computer links, all these other elements. And if they develop that identity, now people in the marketplace may purchase their product because they see them differently. Are you following me on this? Remember what the process of identity really means. It means that if I think you're a great guy and you're my best friend and you treat me really vicious, I may get upset about that. But sure enough, after a while, I'll rationalize it and say, well, you're probably having a, what, bad day. But if I think you're a manipulator, if I think you're a liar, if I think you don't care about me or anybody else, and one day you start treating me really nice, I'm going to say in my head, what does he want? You see, what controls my responsiveness to you is not the fact that you re-engineered your life to be a nice guy now. What controls it is my concept of you. Classic example is government. Government wants to reinvent itself by doing a better job. Well, if they go out and re-engineer like crazy, but as long as we think of government as a bunch of fat cats who are wasting our money, unless we create a new identity for government, we'll keep noticing what they don't do well, and they'll never change their identity, and the re-engineering process really won't last. There'll be no reinforcement for it. Do you follow me on this? So as I began to develop this concept and really start to think it through, I realized there were more steps than just reinventing or creating a new identity and more than re-engineering. In the middle of designing this, I got this giant stimulus to really develop this process with more precision. And what happened was I scheduled a tour for the United Kingdom to go over to Great Britain, and I developed a set of relationships and partnerships. And as I began to develop some press over there, I got a phone call from one of the top industrialists in the United Kingdom, a man by the name of Richard Field of Dyson & Dyson. And he comes from a community called Sheffield. And he invited me to come there to Sheffield, the fourth largest city in the United Kingdom, Great Britain, not to do a seminar, not to do a speech, but he threw down the gauntlet and gave me a challenge. He said, listen, your whole life has been about helping people to create change. You've done it with individuals, you've done it with sports teams, you've done it with companies. He said, what if you took on the next level of challenge and decided to really help turn around an entire community, the fourth largest city in our nation? He said, because we're in trouble. And he said, you know what? If you were to come and help us and coach us through the process, we think we could turn this thing around. I said, well, what's the challenge? He said, the challenge is Sheffield has always been known for its steel industry and for its fine silver. I said, I'm very familiar with Sheffield silver. And he said, we have a major problem. There's tremendous competition in the steel industry now. There's brand new technology. And so we don't have the same level of profitability. And because of technology, we are producing as much steel here in Sheffield as we did at the peak of the steel industry, but we're employing 1/20th of the number of people we originally did. He said, there are portions of our community where we have 76% unemployment. Can you imagine? And he said, the bottom line is people are getting depressed here. They're starting to feel like there's no future. They don't know what to do. And he said, you know, I listened to one of your tapes. You talked about this learned helplessness. And he said, that's what's happening here. And he said, you know, I think that if anybody could help turn around, you could. And I said, well, I'm complimented that you would think of me. I'm not sure the exact process I'd go through, but I'd love the challenge. I have to tell you that the concept of turning a whole community around and the challenge of taking this process on, and it's a 5 to 10 year process of regenerating an entire community, was so exciting. I thought, man, you have to have a lot of audacity to think you could even do this. But I thought, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do it with a team. I can help to coach it. I can help ask the questions. But what I really need is a model on how to pull this off. How the heck am I going to do it? I know how the fundamentals of change, but I need a model of a community that's already done this. Then it'll show me even the steps. That'll show me the steps of maybe re-engineering. And how do I retrain? What would we do? How would we approach this? So I agreed to do it, not having a clue how I was going to go about it initially. And I thought, okay, I've been studying re-engineering. I'm studying this whole concept I'm creating called regeneration. Well, who else has regenerated a community? And so I came across several examples in the United States, but I thought, I need an example from Great Britain so people there will not see this as an American coming to do something and turn around, but just a person who's reporting to them what's already being done in their own nation successfully. And so I finally found out of an organization called Dean Clough. Now listen to this example and think about how it relates to the company you work with. Think how it relates to your own community. Think about how it relates maybe even to your personal life, metaphorically. Dean Clough was a carpet manufacturer. I think approximately 70, 80-year-old carpet manufacturer, well known throughout the world for producing fine wool carpets. Dean Clough is based in a small community in the north of England called Halifax. They're based in the middle of this valley were these 70 buildings with 1.5 million square feet called Dean Clough, this giant carpet manufacturer, which obviously the dominant employer in the community. Well, this was fine for decades, generations, if you will, until good old technology came along and changed the whole basis of competition. With synthetics and international competitors, all of a sudden in the early 1980s, I believe 1981, overnight, Dean Clough shut down. Can you imagine a small community like this where 5,000 people were being employed by this carpet manufacturer for generations, where each generation counted on this as the source of their future generation's security and jobs, their ability to provide for their family, and overnight it closes up? I mean, can you imagine the emotional devastation, not to mention the economic devastation this created? And also, what you got to see every day is all of a sudden, all these jobs are gone. These people cannot provide for their families. And every day they're driving by this huge center of town where these 70 filthy buildings, has they not been renovated or regenerated, if you will, for decades? And so as a result, this giant mass of filthy, empty buildings stood there as a constant reminder that the future was going to be worse than the past, that there was no future, that there was no employment, that their children would not be able to grow up and have a better quality of life, that the world had changed, that technology had passed them by. Again, imagine the devastation to these families. Now, what turned it around? And there is a good side of the story, so hang in there with me. And that is one man who made a decision. And his name is Sir Ernest Hall. In fact, he didn't have Sir in front of his name when he first did this in 1982. In 1982, Sir Ernest Hall came along, walked through several of these buildings, and bought the rest of them sight unseen. Bought all 70 buildings, 1.5 million square feet. He said, you know what? I'm going to turn this around. My family grew up here. I want them to have a better future. He said, my kids live here. I want them to have a great future. I'm going to help regenerate this entire community. I know that's the word he used, but that was his idea. I'll tell you the words he actually did use because I had the privilege of meeting him and spending hours and hours interviewing him and becoming very good friends. So Ernest Hall said, I want to create a practical utopia. That was his goal. That was his reinvention of the community that he wanted to produce where carpet manufacturing had once been. Now, what does this mean? Well, first of all, understand a little about Sir Ernest Hall's background. Today, he's a world-class pianist. For most of his life, he was involved in the arts, and he pulled from them so much joy and passion and juice for his life that it is something that he always wanted to share with other people. Simultaneously, from a practical standpoint, in order to be effective in supporting his family, he became a businessman and became quite successful in the textiles business. Now, as a result of this, he always felt like his arts background had put vigor into his business and helped him to be successful. So his idea of a practical utopia was this. He said, you people are right. There is no future in terms of inviting one big corporation to move out here to Halifax and take over these old buildings and provide jobs. It's not going to happen. He said, the future is not big corporations. It's small corporations. It's tiny entrepreneurships that all feed off one another, that all synergize. He said, I'm going to create a community here, a practical utopia. And here's what he did. He went out and he invited, can you imagine this, these 70 buildings, 1.5 million square feet. And his first person he put in one of the buildings was a guy that repaired cars, a one-man operation. Right next to him, he put a computer firm, high tech. Next to them, he put a printing firm. Then he got himself a little deli in there eventually. Simultaneously, he went to the arts community and he said, I want you to come help me transform this place. I'm going to give you space as long as you're productive. All I want you to do is do your best work, and before it's sold, display it in this facility. So sure enough, he went out and got these artists, and here's what happened. Synergy. These artists would go out, and one man, for example, is a photographer. He's out there at 5:30 in the morning taking photographs. When people start arriving to do business at 7:30 and 8, they see this man out there with this unbelievable intensity and passion taking all these pictures. At lunch, they walk outside. He's still out there taking pictures. At 6 o'clock, 5:30, 5 o'clock, some of them late as 7 o'clock at night, he's still out there taking pictures. Pretty soon people start asking him after day, what are you doing? And he told them, well, I'm working hard to discover when is the perfect ambient light to produce a photograph I want that'll move people in a certain way. People, business people walk away scratching their heads at first. But after enough time, they developed a tremendous respect and, more importantly, the passion rubbed off. These people began to raise their own standards for what they demanded from themselves and their own businesses. Suddenly, the synergy started happening. Simultaneously, these artists were reinforced like crazy. Normally, they're off by themselves, isolated. Now they had people coming saying, God, I always thought art was such a waste, or I can't believe how much work goes into it, how much creativity. I mean, you're a genius. I love your work. So the artists got reinforced, which made them more creative. The business people got more inspired. And what happened is this became a community, which is now, 10 years later, responsible for regenerating the entire city of Halifax. Because here's what happened. 75% of that 1.5 million square feet is now leased out to new businesses. Individual businesses, it's like going to a college or a university, and everybody seems to know each other. It's a blast to go there. Most importantly, they employ in that space now more people than they did at the height of the carpet manufacturing. Here's what happened to real estate values. In a city that was totally depressed, commercial real estate went from $1.50 a square foot to today $13 a square foot. So Ernest Hall's investment in trying to make the world a better place has made him a pretty profit as well. For all the money he's invested has grown along with the real estate. Most importantly, he didn't stop there. He convinced one of the richest women in Great Britain to donate money to create a children's museum where children learn by doing, so people come from all over England to have their children come through this experience. He also attracted and negotiated and persuaded one of the top ballet companies in the United Kingdom to come and be based there. He and the people he's inspired have created a culture in Halifax that's made it a thriving community from scratch. Now, why do I tell you all this? Because I'm going to break down the steps that they went through to regenerate an entire community. And by the way, that's what I began to do using this as the model for Sheffield. And then I began to look at it again for corporations and for our business lives. So in Sheffield, what I began to do is the same thing you'd want to do in your business or in your personal life. I took stock. I went to step number one of regeneration. We need to reinvent this community. Now, what does that mean? Well, first, to reinvent something, you got to know what you are. What kind of business are you in? What do you currently do? If you're a community, what is your community really like? Be honest with yourself. I remember talking to General Schwarzkopf, and one of the most important things he said was so simple. He said, no organization can get better unless they're willing to admit what must be improved, that certain things are not right, they're not as good as they can be, or they're flat messed up. So you gotta see where you really are and be dirt honest with yourself about your organization, about how you do business. In this case, what's the community really like? What are its strengths? What are its weaknesses? What are the problems? What are some potential solutions? And so I gathered with the help of the industrialists in the area, 600 people from every walk of life. We've got people, for example, who are the heads of universities, head of the medical profession there, head of businesses, people from every ethnic community, people from the religious sector, children, housewives involved in this process of regenerating Sheffield. And what we did is we did a detailed survey of what are the problems, what are the solutions, what upsets people, what needs to be turned around. And then we held a big meeting, and I flew to Sheffield and met with these 600 people at the university. And what we discussed were what were the problems and the solutions. And I talked to them about the fact that what we really need to do is regenerate the whole community, and that the number one challenge, having toured there, was obviously unemployment. That all crime challenges, the challenges with the community's tax base, changes that they want to make like airports, all required first that there be a greater level of employment. That the old industries, the steel industries, for example, were not going to ever produce the same number of jobs as they did in the past. Technology had wiped that out, as well as competition. What we agreed is we have to track, obviously, a new set of industries, a new set of companies, companies that will thrive in the 21st century. So as we did that, I said, so what prevents us from being able to recruit these companies, I believe, is one factor, the identity that people now have for Sheffield in the UK and on the continent. Because the identity of Sheffield is an old steel town that's on its way down. I said, correct me if I'm wrong. I said, it's also considered dirty. It's also considered a lot of other things. When in reality, you have some of the most incredible hospitals, some of the most incredible universities. You have incredible resources here. You have an incredible work ethic. You have people who have tremendous pride. You have technology that's always made you the leader in steel production and silver. I said, so what we have to do is tap into those real resources, but unless we change the identity, none of it will matter. So people got very excited. Then I invited Sir Ernest Hall to work with us in showing us how we can begin to really re-engineer the community. Because what he found is when you change a person's environment, when you design an environment, it begins to change identity and it changes the way in which businesses actually do their work, changes the process. So we're looking at doing that now with this community. There are a variety of other steps, but to make a long story short, without telling all the details of Sheffield, as a result of the work that we're doing there, I had the privilege of being invited to speak at Parliament while I was still in the UK. I had the opportunity to speak before the members of the House of Commons and members of the House of Lords. Well, you talk about a challenging group to talk to. They're great, but I'll tell you what, it really challenged my ability to articulate these principles and get them across. And while it was a great privilege, it was an even greater honor to see that I was able to get through. Because not only did I get a standing ovation, which was a wonderful gift, but people came up to me afterwards and started talking to me about how this could be used in the various communities that they represent. So I'm excited about what this concept can mean. And a couple days later, I was invited to come speak in Washington, D.C. with the top 400 members of government who control all the agencies of the U.S. government and talk about the concept of regeneration to a group on reinventing government. And now we're being invited to participate in the process of regeneration within companies throughout the United States. The point of the matter is, let me now briefly share with you the five fundamental processes for tapping into your resources, using those resources that right now are dormant in a brand new way that turn problems into assets, that turn waste into assets that dramatically improve the quality of life for your business and for your personal life, what we call regeneration. Here it is very briefly. Step number one, I've already told you, is reinventing. Now, what does it mean to reinvent? What really this first step of reinventing is number one, you got to get a vision. The vision of what do you want things to be like? Number two, you got to make a decision. You got to make sure you flat decide you're not going to turn back, that this is how it's going to be. And number three, you've got to communicate, not only to yourself, but other people you're interacting with, that this is what you're committed to. Step three of regeneration is you've got to reassure the people involved. Now, if you're trying to regenerate yourself, you're going to need some reassurance, because in the beginning, you're going to go out and it's going to be hard. That's where a coach can be so valuable, because they reassure you, hey, it's going to be worth it. You're going to make it through. Hang in there. Same thing is true in a company. When we start making changes, people get fearful. They need to have a sense that, hey, this is really going to work. Reassuring just means that in the initial and in the ongoing process of constantly dispelling people's doubts, making certain that they feel like change is going to be safe, secure, but most important, it's going to be worth it. People have to be reassured to stay on board, and the same thing is true if you want to regenerate your life. The fourth element of regeneration is you've got to retrain. That is, in the case of your body, you've got to retrain muscles. You've got to teach them how to function differently. In the organization, you've got to retrain people on how to do things more efficiently. Because if you re-engineer everything, and you've got this brand new identity, and you've reassured everybody, but their old habits of doing things, their old training, their old conditioning will keep them from doing things that will make the company profitable or make the job more efficient or make the family happier or whatever the case may be of what you're trying to regenerate. And finally, you got to revitalize your life, your organization, your community, your family. And the way you do that is very simple. You take immediate action on this reinvention, this reengineering, this reassuring, and this retraining. You take immediate action on your plan. Revitalization occurs in an organization when people see it's not just the newest fad, that these things are actually happening. Changes are occurring. The secret is you've got to notice, promote, and publicize the small successes so they can stack upon one another and create momentum. Now, let me take each one of these just real briefly and give you one example from a community, from a business, and maybe an example that relates to a personal life so you can finally embed this. And let me give you your homework and get out of here and go regenerate your life or your business. Here's what we do. Looking back at reinventing as the first step. Here's another classic example from a community. In Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, near Vancouver Island, there is a small little community that up until 10 years ago, almost no one had ever heard of before. In fact, the community is made up of only 3,500 people, but it is now known worldwide. How did this happen? Well, the community's name is Chemainus. This is a little town that's been basically a mill town for the timber industry. All the way up until 1980, when all of a sudden, the mill in the area that basically, again, employed almost everybody in the community, shut down. Now, here's a town whose entire economic well-being is dependent upon the forestry industry. Now, what'd they do? Well, again, most people panicked, but the mayor of the town, a man with some vision by the name of Graham Bruce, got together with one of the businessmen from the local area called Carl Schultz, and they went about figuring out how would they revitalize this entire community. What could they do? What could they do without this forestry industry? First of all, they said, we have to reinvent ourselves. We have to get people to see us differently. As long as people see us as a mill town, no one's ever going to come here. And we have to attract people here so we can provide jobs. And there's no business that's going to come here. There's no real room for business. We have to become a tourist attraction somehow. Now, how do you go from being a mill town to a tourist attraction? You come up with some way to attract people. And so they said, what we have to do is become an artistic community. We already have some great artists here. Sounds a lot like Dean Clough, doesn't it? They said, let's use that as a magnet. We have a few murals around town. What if we painted these larger-than-life murals all over town? and became known as the town of murals, not only, you know, here on the island, but throughout Canada, maybe around the world. They began to develop a vision. Sound familiar? Reinvention. They made some decisions. They started to communicate this with other people. They then went to step two. They got a group of people together, and they actually began to re-engineer the town and saying, how would we organize it? We don't want to just put random murals. We need to do something that's going to really cause people to want to come here. And the murals should have some kind of sequence to them. They must have something to do with the history of the area. And they developed this intense, detailed plan of how they're going to dramatically, immediately change people's perception of that community and their desire to come and be there and visit there and spend their money there. Third thing they did is they had to reassure everybody that they weren't crazy. Right? Oh, we're going to go around and paint this mill town up with these giant murals. And sure, people are going to fly in from all over the world just to see this. Sure. Fourth thing they had to do was retrain people. They had to retrain them about how to think about their community. They had to retrain them about how to communicate what their community was about. They had to retrain all the people involved on what kind of skills they needed. They had to bring in other types of skills to the area, other kinds of coaching. They had to attract other artists. They had to develop businesses that would meet the tourists' needs. And finally, they had to revitalize. They had to promote this compelling future to everyone around them, and they had to capture every little success, especially for those who were negative and thought nothing would change it anyway. Today, it's known as the little town that did, because in 1983, they won the New York City Downtown Renovation Award, and they literally have transformed this community through the process of regeneration. At Hallmark, looking at the process of reengineering is very, very important, and they're doing a phenomenal job of reengineering there. But as I met with the president of the company only a couple weeks ago, I communicated to him that what's equally important, in my opinion, they have to reinvent themselves. Because as he already communicated to me, the marketplace has changed. People want their individual needs met. And I said, you know, the other challenge is as long as the model for Hallmark is for those who care enough to send the very best, you got a problem. He said, yeah, we know we have a problem. People think we're more expensive. We're really not more expensive in our cards. I said, it's more than that. People want to feel smart in today's society. A large number of people, they want to be smart. And so being smart is getting things for a good buy, but also, listen, you're competing. He said, I know. You're not telling me anything new. He said, we've done our homework. We know. We're competing with the discount stores, right? Most people just run in, grab a card. It's cheaper. It's discounted. It's nearby. And then move on. I said, yes, so you got to get people to go in your Hallmark store. And he said, yes, our plan, our strategy is that we need to create specialty stores. So Hallmark is really a specialty store. I said, that's great. And so we talked about it a great deal. And I talked to several of the executives there. And I have to tell you, of all the companies I've been involved with, I've never seen more commitment to the company, to each other, to the distributors than I saw at Hallmark. These people, they live Hallmark. They have a passion for this company, and they're committed to reengineering and regenerating. But as we went through conversations, I said, let's look at your identity. What are these stores really? What's the added value that you bring to the table? Yes, you have nice cards. Lots of people have nice cards. What is Hallmark really about? What's the business you're really in? You're not a specialty business. What are you really in? And we dug and we dug and we dug. Until one of the top vice presidents there said, you know, what we are is we're about the celebration of life. I said, that's what you have. You got to have celebration of life stores. He said, yeah, Hallmark. He said, we're how you celebrate life and death. Birth, marriage, your top date, love, joy. He said, those products never go out of style. He said, that's what we're really about. And he got so emotional. I was moved myself. I thought, that's the business I'm in. I thought, how incredible. That's what you have to communicate. Not that because you care enough to send the very best. I said, Hallmark's frame should be Hallmark, a celebration of life. Can you imagine the imagery? You see the child taking his first steps. You see the couple meeting for the very first time. You see that silver anniversary couple. You see the football game won. You see all those celebrations of life. I said, you've got to create that identity so that people have a different association to Hallmark other than just, well, they got good cards that are expensive when they really are the best cards and they're not any more expensive. I said, otherwise the re-engineering process will still have some limits. And I said, I don't know if you agree with my phraseology or not, but the metaphor I'm offering you is one I really want you to think about. And they are. They're looking at how to expand their identity. It's such a critical step. Reengineering will not work without it. Does that make sense to you? I hope so. What about step two, reengineering? Let's look at it real quickly in detail. Under reengineering, let me give you a simple example. How about a company called Disney? Why is this company one of the finest organizations on the face of the earth? because they know more about their customers' needs than almost anyone. They're constantly discovering what does that customer really need and finding a way to serve them better. They're constantly reinventing, re-engineering, retraining, reassuring, and revitalizing their organization. They're an organization that is always looking for a quantum leap in the quality of what they do. And when I was in Washington, D.C. at the Reinventing Conference, I had the opportunity to share the platform with a man by the name of Judson Green. He was the president of Walt Disney Attractions, an amazing man and a listener to Personal Power and Power Talk, by the way. Now, he did one of the best speeches I've ever heard about how to really make your organization customer-oriented. But one of the secrets to Disney's success is they are constantly making decisions about how to improve their identity. He told me that they did some research and they found that 85% of all the people that leave Walt Disney World would recommend a Walt Disney World vacation to their friends. Now, he said, for years we took great pride in that fact. He said, until one day, he said, they began to reevaluate the whole process. He said they raised their standards by creating this project of focusing on excellence in serving the customer. And they said, you know what this really means? It means that 15% of the people, which for them, when they service 70 million people in a year, that means millions of people would not recommend Walt Disney World. He said, that's horrible. So what they did is they raised their standards instead of feeling great about it, and they made a brand new set of decisions, started communicating that they were going to raise the standards. Now, to re-engineer, the way Disney did it is they went to their hotels, for example, in Walt Disney World, and instead of hiring an outside firm, they went to their own people and said, you know what works here. You know what you make better here. Help us figure this out. And teams put together a project that he said would have cost them probably a $100,000 consulting fee from someone on the outside, telling them all the things they could do that would be so simple to immediately impact the customer in a more powerful way and a more profitable way for the organization as well. He said also what they began to do is take this reengineering process into the way they did their accounting. And he said what they did is they found a way to cut their billing time from 35 days of work to 5 days of work. What they did also is it cut their collection time in half, which means they got their cash a lot quicker. Now, I don't know if that made all their people that they were billing happier, but it made them a lot happier and more profitable. But probably my favorite example that he gave was he said, you know, in order to be successful in business today and really understand reengineering, you have to know when to change your sheets. What he meant by that, as it turned out, was he said that at one of the Walt Disney hotels, they decided to just try something. They decided to see if they didn't have to change the sheets every night. That's what they've always done, assuming that that really mattered to the customer. Now, I'll give you a little secret. In reengineering, one of the questions you want to ask is, does the customer care? So much that goes on in a business, for example, customers don't even care about, and yet you spend a lot of time, energy, and money getting it done because you think they care. You think it matters. The bottom line is, he said, we're going to try this. And they tried it, and they put a little note next to people's beds that says, we change our sheets once every 3 days. If you'd like them changed every night, we're happy to do so. Please just call the front desk. He said, in 22,000 room nights, only 3 people ever made the request to have the sheets changed. He said, do you have any idea what that means economically when you take in all the room nights that we do in all the hotels? He said, more importantly even, think about this. Not only does it make us more profitable, but we save 1 million gallons of water a year. We save enough electricity to power 5 homes 24 hours a day for a year. We save enough natural gas to heat 100 homes for an entire year. He said, all we're doing is we're using our resources more efficiently. I thought, doesn't that sound familiar? He said, and what we're doing is we're massively improving the bottom line, and we're using our resources intelligently, and we've made our organization that much better, and we're spending our money on what the customer really cares about instead of things they don't care about. That's a really simple example of step 2 in regeneration, of re-engineering. Just realize that companies have found a way to add more value to their customers than ever before and explode in their profitability, sometimes anywhere from 20 to 80% by going through these processes of re-engineering. On step 3 in reassuring, that's part of what we're doing for Hallmark, is going out and communicating with people with certainty their commitment to do a better job than ever to really serve the customer. One of the things that Hallmark did extremely well is when they began the re-engineering process, they thought it through in such detail, and they went out and communicated to their people and said, we're not just going to chop up the company or downsize or right-size, that we're going to live by the same values. We're just going to do it more intelligently. We're going to figure a way to add more value. They communicated what the values of the company were and what was not going to change. While processes of the business may change, certain commitments to excellence would not. This is critical to any organization or change. And if you're trying to, for example, let's say, regenerate the quality of your relationship, and all of a sudden you go reinvent yourself and how you interact with this person, you re-engineer the time you spend them, when you also reassure them that the essence of the relationship has not changed. This is true in almost any aspect of regeneration. Step 4, retrain. Now, again, just as you have to retrain a set of muscles, you got to retrain staff so that they really work at functional efficiency, because we got bad habits. We don't follow through and get the ultimate result very often, not because we can't, but because we just have the habits of doing things that are inefficient. I'll give you an example that might be kind of different than you would anticipate. I've recently had the privilege of spending some time with some very special people. Their names are Mark and Delia Owens. Now, you may be familiar with their names because they've written two international bestsellers. The latest one is called The Eye of the Elephant. Now, these two people have basically spent their life studying lions, and then in recent years, they went to Zambia to study really the elephants, because they found in this part of Zambia where almost 80% of the elephant population had been eliminated, killed by poachers over a 10-year period of time, all for the ivory. Another classic example of us using our resources in a totally ineffective way that destroys not only the quality of life for the elephants, but the quality of life for human beings for generations to come. Fortunately, this couple single-handedly have used the regeneration process to change an entire portion of a country. And in the last year, there's not been one elephant poached. How'd they do it? Number one, they made a decision. Sound familiar? They decided that they had to create a new identity for the poachers, because the poachers were made up primarily of villagers. And they realized they had to see where things really were, that these people were living off the ivory from these elephants. And it was the only way they knew how to do things. They had to create a new identity for them, a new way of thinking about themselves. And they decided that they were going to be personally responsible to make it happen. They also understood they had to re-engineer. They had to change the process of how these people made a living. And they had to reassure them not only it was possible, but they had to retrain these people to actually come up with a new occupation and reinforce them until there was a revitalization of this community. Now, how do you do that in the middle of Africa where people don't speak your own language? Well, the first step is you got to break the pattern of the slaughter of these elephants within the park. So in order to do this, Mark went out and hired some of the locals to become deputies. Well, they didn't have a lot of skill in fighting off other poachers, and it wasn't very effective, so he used an airplane. And what he did was he would find these poachers, and he would scare them. He would literally strafe them. He would drop, you know, flares and things to scare them out of the park. Now, that may break the pattern for the moment, but you have to give them another option, something else to do. So Delia would meet them as they're leaving the park to show them how they could create jobs that would produce more income than poaching that would actually be easier, so they'd want to do it. So, for example, they'd go to a community and they'd start talking to these people and saying, now, how much harder is it for you to hunt down an elephant than it was for your grandfather? How much further do you have to go? Do you notice how many fewer there are? And they had to teach them and reassure them and show them that these elephants were worth more alive than they were dead, because they could bring something called tourists, which these poachers and these villagers knew nothing about. And they literally began to teach them basket weaving and other skills of products and services they could sell. They took them through the entire regeneration process. So effective are they that the elephants in the last year, there's not been a single elephant that's been poached in a year, all by the regeneration efforts of this community. And it's an ongoing project where they are beginning to restore the elephant population by understanding the same principles that'll turn around a community, or it'll turn around a business, or it'll turn around your personal life. So have I dumped enough examples on you? Have I ranted and raved enough? I'm just trying to get you to see that this process of regeneration is the ability to tap into your creativity, to use human ingenuity to make things better than they've ever been before. The only thing holding you back are your past limiting beliefs about what you're capable of, or what you've tried in the past and it didn't work, or your beliefs about how it can only be done one way. If you'll break all the rules, throw everything away, start with a fresh piece of paper, a fresh idea, and with a sense of certainty that there is a way to not only make your life better, your business better, or your community better, but to do it in a way that's profitable and successful and fun, and you're not willing to settle for anything less than success, if you make it an absolute must, you can't believe what you can figure out. And it's been done for years. Regeneration is just a term for what we've always been doing, and it's giving you a sense of steps to think about. Making the decision of what identity you want, communicating it, making sure you figure out how can I do this differently? If we're going to do this more efficiently, if we're going to do this radically differently, if we're going to do this better than we've ever done it before in a brand new way that was more profitable, easier, more fun, what would it be? And keep digging till you come up with an answer. Because ask and you shall receive only if you demand the answer from yourself again and again. And the reality is if you get a team of people and you develop some synergy, you'll come up with answers you'd never come up with on your own. And of course, you've got to reassure, retrain, and revitalize. And you know what? No matter how successful your life is, no matter how much you've accomplished, if you're not experiencing all the joy and passion that you want, then maybe it's time to do some regeneration. Maybe it's time to make some decisions about what you want your life to be like again. Maybe it's time to re-engineer it. Look at how you've organized your life and make sure you can get the same goals or maybe better goals with less stress. My point is real simple. No one is trapped in a box. No one has no choice except the person who believes it. Not living in the society that you and I live in. We have total freedom to create it any way we want it. Think about regeneration in a brand new way. Realize regeneration is a way you could contribute. You could figure a way to help regenerate your company. Wouldn't that be nice? Or maybe part of the process, the re-engineering at your company or the retraining. Maybe you can just be a source of reassuring people so people aren't so fearful about the future because you have a better understanding of where things are going and why the changes are occurring. Hopefully this tape has given you some insight in that area. You don't have to do all of this. I just wanted this tape to provide you with a couple of things. One, an understanding of where some of the most important changes are happening within our society, where they're coming from, and where it's going to take us. An idea, too, of how can you take control of your own destiny? How can you turn around an organization, a community, a family, or your life? A way of looking at it, a frame of reference. Obviously, I haven't listed every single step in detail. That's part of your own creativity to figure out how to do it for you. There is no right or wrong way. You can get some coaching to assist you, or you can do it completely on your own. If there's one thing I want you to remember from this tape, it's to remember what human ingenuity, what your innate creativity can produce. I mean, just think about what you're capable of again, and instead of just thinking about it, do something. Make some decisions and use this simplistic metaphor of regeneration and this outline of some of the steps to guide you through the process of producing a massive and dramatic change in the quality of your life. You can not just do it for yourself, you can do it, for example, in your community. There's a group in Baltimore headed by a man by the name of Joseph Hammer. It's called Project Life. And what they've done is they said, okay, what's regeneration? How do we use some human ingenuity, some creativity, some thinking to use dormant resources in a way that massively improves the quality of life? Well, how about we help the homeless out here? How do we do it? Out there in Baltimore Harbor, they got an old Navy hospital ship that's deteriorating and not being used in any way, just sitting there rotting away. And guess what? If you go out on the hospital ship, you find out there is a huge mess hall, that there are dozens of dentist chairs, that there are more than 1,000 places for people to stay. And what they've done is they've made a decision to create a new identity for that hospital ship. And that is, it's going to become a community stabilization and human revitalization center where people who are either chemically or economically depressed can go and be revitalized, regenerated in their life. And right now they're beginning the process and doing it without any government money whatsoever, just using resources in a new way. And by the way, when is it time to regenerate? There's a good question for you. When do you know now is the time? Well, you look at your watch and whatever time it is, that is the time to begin regenerating. I mean, why would you put off having a better quality of life? Why would you put off asking the questions that could unleash your imagination, your creativity, and your resources to make your life better? In fact, very often when I talk to people and I see people have tremendous talent or skill or ability, but they really haven't created mastery in their life, they haven't really tapped into their real potential, it's usually because those things are still a should and not a must. You have to understand, when you're regenerating, that first step of reinvention is not just coming up with a vision, but making that vision an absolute must, where no matter what, you've made a decision and it will happen, period. Because really, that sense of urgency is the drive that comes from deep inside of me and makes me like suck every ounce out of an idea or concept. Go out and give 10,000% when I'm out there. When I think there's nothing left in my body, I give more because I have this sense of destiny. Like, as corny as it may sound, and it's not corny sounding to me, honestly, is that I've got to make the biggest difference I can in this moment. I've got to maximize it. I want to make sure that when my life is over, there's not a drop left. That every part of me is used, that I've been a servant, that I've made the difference, that I've done what I was capable of doing. And I don't know how you install that in someone except to get them around other people who have that same sense of urgency. And if you're not around that, you need to find it and pursue it. You don't want to ever be in a position of regret just because you didn't take action. Regeneration is something to begin now, not someday. Here's your homework. The first step is really simple. Decide on something you want to re-engineer or regenerate. It might be something as simple as one room in your house. You ask yourself the questions, what do you want it to be about? How could you do it better? What could you do if you could have it any way you wanted it? Take away all your things about what can't be done and think creatively. If you want to take this to a deeper level of taking on a regeneration, then look at some other area of your life that bugs you, that's giving you some pain, and use the outline we've talked about here. Let's say you want to regenerate your body. Let's say you want to regenerate your finances. You want to regenerate your relationship. What's the first step? You need to make some decisions. You need to reinvent the relationship. You need to think about this person a new way. Have them think about you. How do you want them to feel about you? How do you want to feel about them? How do you want to interact? Secondly, what can you do about the way you live your life to re-engineer this relationship? What can you do so you spend the time together that would be really special instead of time when you're both exhausted from the day? Or what could you organize? Could you produce something called a date night, a new system? What could you do that would not just make it a little bit better or improve it a bit, but something that would maybe totally change the whole thing, change the whole relationship for the better on a radical level? Thirdly, what could you do to reassure this person how much you love them or how important they are to you? What could you do to retrain yourself so you don't find yourself arguing or nitpicking about little stuff that just doesn't even matter, but it ends up really messing up the feeling of love that you could have? And lastly, how do you revitalize it? What could you do to create some momentum? What are some little successes you could build on? How could you keep noticing them so that you stay inspired to keep regenerating this relationship and the other person really gets excited about it as well? You can do this in any area of your life. And if you want to take it to a third level, you do it at the business level. You do it in your career. What do you want your career to be like? What do you want your identity to be? Develop a vision for what you want long-term in your career. Make some decisions. Communicate to the people around you and yourself. Make it clear. Develop a system that's going to move you in the direction you want to go so you're not surprised by the changes that occur. Take a look down and figure out how you're going to reassure yourself so you stay on track and don't give up and don't get burnt out. What are you going to do to retrain yourself? What additional education or skills do you need? What do you need to do to really catch yourself doing things right and revitalize? And by the way, this month's book summary is What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School by Mark McCormick. This is a book that was written a long time ago, but I brought it back because Mark's success in the sports management business is unparalleled, and the distinctions and strategies he's offered are truly timeless. They'll work for you today as much as they did then, because these are the principles basically that influence the way human beings interact in business. People who've started with very little have shaped history, and the biggest difference was the size of their thinking and the level of their commitment to action, their willingness to ask questions no one else asked, their willingness to create a vision, whether it be a Martin Luther King talking about his dream or a Kennedy thinking about landing on the moon, or whether it be a young lawyer named Gandhi who had nothing but his vision and his willingness to ask questions no one else was asking, his willingness to re-engineer, think of a brand new way of approaching the relationship with England in such a way that created independence for his country from the British Empire. Think about what one human being can do through the power of vision, decision, communication, creative questioning, the reassurance that comes from conviction, the constant process of re-education and retraining, and the compelling future and the small successes that build to create the momentum of lasting change. Who we are and what we're capable of is so far beyond our present concept, it's a joke. Isn't it time you tapped into those dormant resources around you? Whether it be the intellect of your friends, the products or services that sit in front of you, or just your imagination, I shouldn't say just because maybe that's the greatest resource, to turn these dormant ideas, resources, elements into significant assets that massively improve the quality of your life and all those people you have the privilege to touch. What a wonderful time to be alive. A time in which people's creativity has allowed us to come to the point where technology, used properly, doesn't create unemployment, but creates employment of our greatest resources, our minds and spirits. One final example for you. Just recently, a report came out about a brand new prosthesis device where scientists have figured out through creativity and ingenuity how to tap into dormant cells in the body so that you can now have a prosthesis device, for example, a leg where a man has lost his leg, and he can actually feel the artificial leg and run on it. We're entering a world where technology has the capability to revolutionize our concept of what a quality life will be. I invite you to begin the process of taking advantage of its resources starting today. Till our next session, please enjoy yourself, create some regeneration, and live with